at the same time, I've had to really accept and understand that when someone else chooses to take their own life, of course, there are the questions and the what ifs and the if onlys that we all put ourselves through. And that's something that I've certainly struggled with. We can try and keep our eyes open a little more around other people. We can try and, you know, listen to each other a little more closely, but we can't change, you know, what happened for Tony in 2018. And that's been a very hard incremental lesson to accept over the years.
Welcome, you wonderful, purposeful, and beautiful humans to Hope Still Wins. I'm your host, Ben Higgins. Hope Still Wins is a place where we get to know thought leaders from diverse backgrounds and differing worldviews to help us feel less alone, more connected, and move us to become a better world together. Ultimately answering the question, does Hope Still Win? If so, why? And if not, why not? And right now, we're in the middle of a series where I have the honor of interviewing incredible humans, see how hope has played a role in their lives when life takes an unexpected turn. From life-altering diagnosis and adversity to loss of a loved one, bankruptcy, and beyond. We're going to cover it all. In today's episode, I have the honor of sharing my conversation with Lori Woolever. Lori is a writer and editor, and best known for her time as an assistant to the late TV host, author, and producer, and one of my personal favorite humans, Anthony Bourdain. Lori released two books last year, World Travel, which she started writing with Anthony before his sudden death, and became an instant New York Times bestseller. She is also the author of Bourdain, the definitive oral biography, where Lori interviews nearly 100 of Bourdain's closest friends and family and colleagues to piece together a full and vivid vision of his work and life. I personally enjoyed Anthony Bourdain's intention, his ability to listen, his ability to create. And I know a lot of the stuff that I've read and seen of Anthony came from Lori. And so I want to get to know Lori better and who she is. And I think during this episode, you will be able to. We talk about what does it mean to lose a friend? You know, what does it mean to grieve? How does life change when somebody takes their life? Unfortunately, Anthony took his life about 3.5 years ago. So how is she doing with that? And well, how has her friends and families and colleagues rallied around? All right, well, it's just time to jump into it. Let's do it. On this episode of Hope Still Wins, here's my conversation with Lori. Lori, thank you so much for joining Hope Still Wins.
Of course. Thank you for having me. I'm really glad to be here.
You know, I did it in the intro. I talked about you, talked about your relationship with Anthony Bourdain. Anybody that knows me knows I was trying to think of the word to use about my relationship through a television screen and through reading with Anthony. It was an infatuation. It was a little bit for me an envy of just how much he desired life. And, you know, obviously with how he passed, I was asked a bunch of questions. People always ask me, who would the three people be that you would sit down and have dinner with, dead or alive? Anthony would always come up in that conversation for me. So It's an honor to be able to talk to you because you've dug so much into his life, but I want to hear about you as well. So to get started, Lori, do you mind giving us a background of who you are, your career, and how you got to this point?
Sure. I will. I'll try and make it brief. So I went to Cornell University. I didn't really know what I wanted to do. Just kind of got through college, spent some time kind of messing around in New York, trying to figure it out, and went to culinary school after 2 years. I really loved to cook and I loved writing. And I thought maybe there's a way I can put these two things together and make a career for myself. So I went to the French Culinary Institute. Straight out of there, I worked for 3.5 years as Mario Batali's assistant. So this was in the late 90s, early 2000s. Learned a lot about the restaurant business, publishing, cooking, television, just kind of everything. And Mario was actually the person who introduced me to Tony Bourdain back in 2002. Tony had a contract to write his first cookbook, it was called Anthony Bourdain's Layal Cookbook, and he needed somebody to help out with the recipe editing and testing. So I did that job, and that was how I first got to know Tony. I went on to do other things. I was a freelance writer. I was a catering cook. I was a private cook. I was an editor at Wine Spectator magazine and Art Culinaire magazine. And then eventually I came back around and became Tony's assistant in 2009. I'd had a child. I was married. I just wanted to have a different kind of life where I could maybe stay home and spend a little more time with my baby and still work and still use the skills that I had, but in a different way. And it was a perfect fit to be Tony's assistant. He was traveling so much and he needed somebody to kind of be grounded in New York and paying attention to all the details and helping him kind of keep his life on track. So I did that from 2009 until the end of his life.
I'm interested because you are so accomplished. You know, even take away from the books that you've came out with here recently that we're going to talk about, because I'm in the middle of reading one. They've been hard for me to read. This is an interesting interview for me because there's a lot of complexities within my feelings about all of this and kind of my relationship with all of this. But even before these books came out, you're very accomplished. Walking into being Tony's assistant then, and now living, you know, writing these books and telling his story and telling your story alongside of him, what have you learned? Like, where do you find yourself sitting as a human today with so much of this just kind of being new to you and talking about it so often?
Yeah, the last 3, almost 4 years now since Tony died, I guess it's just about 3.5 years, have been a tremendous learning experience for me. You know, he was someone that I thought I knew very, very well. I spoke with him every day for the entire time that I worked for him, and I knew where he was and what he was up to and what he was planning to do. And I think one of the biggest things I've learned since he died is that there's always so much more to a person, even if you're very close with them, even if you're working closely with them, spending a lot of time with them. I think that we all have a lot more going on under the surface than maybe anyone else knows. And that was certainly the case with Tony. You know, I had blind spots. I wanted to believe the sort of rosiest version of things. And as much as I felt I could see through kind of the artifice of what it means to be a television personality and a famous person, I think there was part of me that kind of got swept up in the idealized version of what that life was like. I knew it was tough on him. I knew it was very grueling to travel as much as he did, but I don't think I truly understood the suffering that he was experiencing. He was one of those people who, and this comes up quite a bit in the oral biography, he was one of those people that was very good at keeping others at bay, even his closest friends and his closest family members. He just had a private inner life that he was very, very good at keeping to himself, I think, out of a sense of not wanting to burden other people, of not really understanding the help that might be available to him. And it's heartbreaking to think about that. At the same time, I've had to really accept and understand that when someone else chooses to take their own life, of course there are the questions and the what ifs and the if onlys that we all put ourselves through, and that's something that I've certainly struggled with. But I have to believe that, and I think everyone around me has had to kind of come to the conclusion that this is the way things went. And, you know, we did care for him and care about him and do the best we could by him. And this was a decision that he made for himself. And there is definitely a tendency to take on guilt, to take on responsibility. You know, unfortunately, we can't change the outcome and the choice that he made. You know, we can try and keep our eyes open a little more around other people. We can try and, you know, listen to each other a little more closely, but we can't change, you know, what happened for Tony in 2018. And that's been a very hard incremental lesson to accept over the years.
Well, as you mentioned, for those who don't know, Tony did take his life in 2018. Some would say not the peak of his career, but things were going really good, you know, from the outside looking in as a fan. As somebody didn't know him personally, I did not know him personally. I was like, you know what? This is great. There's great content coming out. There's incredible insights. But it begs me to ask a question to you, because a lot of this and a lot of people listening are going to know of somebody or probably sitting in a space in life where a family member or a friend or maybe themselves are struggling with thoughts of taking their life or really heavy, burdenful moments in their story right now. So for you, as you've now taken a step back, and Tony was complex. I'm reading his book. Think complex might be an understatement. You know, people loved him. People loved to hate him. People loved to be around him. Yet at the same time, he would drive him crazy. Now that you've taken a step back from this and you have processed it with your friends and family and colleagues, what lessons have you learned? Is there anything you wish you would have done? Is there anything that a listener could be doing? Or what hope is there out there within the midst of these stories?
Well, you know, I just want to say off the top, I know that I can only speculate, but I have to believe that Tony would probably shy away from becoming sort of the poster boy for suicide prevention or addiction or depression or all those things. But all of those things are part of his story. You know, the thing that I have learned, you know, going forward is again, to listen to people, to really listen to, you know, to what people are going through, to, you know, think about, people's motivations, you know, I myself am somebody who I believe in therapy. I've seen the same therapist for over 20 years. I believe in, you know, medication if it's prescribed by a doctor. And I think that if we can all sort of, you know, whatever it is that someone needs, whatever help that they are asking for, or if they're not asking for, if someone asks for help or seems like they need help, to take that seriously and to, you know, to suspend judgment. Maybe therapy is not for you or for someone listening in particular. They don't feel that it's important for them. But if there's someone in their life that's seeing a therapist or goes to a group or goes to an addiction, you know, a 12-step program, if we can all kind of suspend our own prejudices, our own, you know, predetermined beliefs about these things and really just try and support each other a little more. You know, I mean, Tony did not lack for support. You know, there were so many people that wanted to help him. If you read the book, you'll see, you know, he had lots and lots of people around him that just wanted the best for him. That if he had given any one of us the chance and said that day, you know, listen, I'm really having a hard time. I mean, there were friends that were there with him. You know, it's just a complicated, it's a complicated thing. You know, I mean, Tony is one person. He's somebody who had addiction issues. He's somebody who had, you know, emotional issues. I think that he was someone who, addiction extended beyond substances, just to his whole approach to life. And it could be really beautiful. And in some ways it was the key to his success, you know, his enthusiasm, his absolute 1000% in, whether it was making television or writing books or doing speaking engagements or, you know, whatever it was that he did it 1000%. You know, in the case of the circumstances of the end of his life, I think romantic love became all consuming and obsessive. So, you know, how do you help a friend like that? Again, it's recognizing those signs, you know, when people are starting to shut you out of their life, when people are starting to behave erratically, you know, there are a million things that I wish I had said to Tony or that I had done differently, but I also know that it was the context of my relationship. You know, he was the boss. Mm-hmm. And I think everyone that speaks in the oral biography sort of acknowledges that he was the guy calling the shots. He was the one in charge. And it was clear that he didn't want to let people in after a certain point. So it is really, really difficult. And all we can do is just support and listen to each other, you know, and I think there is hope in that, you know, in looking at the cautionary tale of Tony Bourdain.
the Human Hope Podcast. I'm telling you, this is a great podcast hosted by Carlos Whitaker. Carlos is an author, speaker, moment maker, spider killer, and hope dealer. He's People Choice Award winner, a former recording artist signed to a major label, a social media maven. He currently spends the majority of his time writing books and speaking on stages around the world. It really began when the Whitakers found their family in America's spotlight with appearances on shows like CBS Early Morning, The Today Show, and more when their viral video, Single Ladies Devastation, went viral. But for Carlos, his wife Heather, and their three children, this viral moment was just a snapshot of the bigger picture. In a time where humanity is desperate to find hope, Carlos Whitaker leads us in conversations that bring us just that. From fun discussions about everyday joy to polarizing and challenging topics, Carlos shows even the most calloused heart that there is hope in humanity. Episodes are released every Thursday. For more on Carlos, follow him on Instagram at loswit and visit carloswhitaker.com. Again, loswit is LOSWHIT. Some of the episodes that I love, just for your memory bank. Episode 14, How I Lost My Family, How I Got Them Back, and How You Can Get Past Your Self-Destructing Behavior. Episode 7, How Are Your Black Friends Doing This Week? Let's Ask Them, with EJ Gaines, Propaganda, and Kareen Abraham. And finally, episode 35, How Does Growing Up on Social Media Really Affect Our Kids? I'm telling you, this is a great podcast worth listening to. Again, it's called Human Hope Podcast, hosted by Carlos Whitaker. You said something at the very beginning. You said he would shy away from probably wanting to be the poster boy of this. You know, it's interesting because as I read your book, and we're going to talk a ton about these books here in just a second, but I'm telling you right now, they're incredible reads. If you followed Anthony Bourdain or not, there's a lot to them to learn. I wonder if a little bit, and tell me if I'm completely wrong, because of his... I mean, how aware was he of his impact within society? Like, how aware was he that there was a 28-year-old guy sitting at home and not missing an episode of him and going, oh, if I had three people dead or alive to sit down at dinner with, he would be one of those. Mm-hmm. How aware of was he of that? And did that play a role in any of this not, like, because he shied away from that, because he's like, I don't want to be the poster boy for anything. good or bad.
Yeah.
Like how much of that would go to why you said what you said?
Well, I think he was aware to an extent, you know, he certainly was aware of his numbers and of the fact that he could fill, a 2,000 to 3,000 seat auditorium with people paying a premium to see him speak for an hour and then maybe meet him afterwards in a meet and greet and do a, you know, shake his hand and get a photo. There were all kinds of concrete information that showed him, you know, how interested people were in what he had to say, you know, his success on television, the sales of his books, et cetera, his social media following was massive. So he was not unaware of that, but we had a really interesting conversation when we were on tour promoting our cookbook Appetites. It was the last night of a maybe 15 city tour. We were back in New York and in Brooklyn at the Brooklyn Academy of Music. And we were in the green room before he went on and he said, oh God, it's so embarrassing to me. I do not understand why people have spent money to come and hear me talk. I just find it, baffling and embarrassing. I said, what are you talking about? You know, it's been a huge success. The book is selling great. You know, we've been flying around on a private jet. Like this is the pinnacle of success. And he was like, you know, I just feel like an absolute fraud. And he had that thing that I think we've talked about a lot in the last few years, this idea of imposter syndrome. And I think it's a very, very common thing. And it was at the moment, it was really shocking to me. You know, I didn't understand that he had this core of sort of self-doubt and self-loathing and inside of him. It was new information. And I wish I had maybe taken that a little more seriously, but you know, I'm not a doctor. I wasn't his therapist. I was his friend and his assistant. So all I could really do was sort of listen and understand. But I think it's useful to remember, you know, I know I have my own self-doubts and my own sense of, am I doing enough, or what's the next step in my career, or, you know, how am I going to, what's the rest of my life look like? And to remember that someone, even someone with such a huge audience and a huge impact like him, still had that sense of self-doubt and self-loathing and that imposter syndrome. And it's, for me, it's always useful to know that I'm not the only one who has these feelings.
It's also interesting to hear, because just in my world in the last few years, I've gotten to be around a bunch of people who are very successful. And those who love to talk about how great they are, I don't really like to be around. But those, it's interesting, because those who have a humility or an understanding, or it's almost in an odd way, like this imposter syndrome is endearing. It's relatable. At least it is to me. And so as you say this, I'm sitting here going, how many times have I heard somebody say this and I haven't listened? I've just gone, oh, I get you. But I haven't actually been listening to that, because, you know, we all know people who are successful in our lives and they talk about their pains and vulnerabilities, and we go, and our typical response is, but look how much you have. Look how good it's going. Look how great you are. Look who's filled up this auditorium to see you speak. But that misses the human part of it. That misses the person telling you. And it goes back, and then we're going to transition into your books here. But it goes back to what you said. One of the best lessons, and I think it's such a key thing, and I want to repeat it, is to just start listening, like actually listening, sitting in that moment.
And it can be uncomfortable. I mean, my instinct is always to do what you just said, to be like, but look how great you are. You're great. Or, you know, don't be so crazy, you know, but it's, but it's not about, I don't think the person in the moment is asking for you to invalidate what they're saying. They just want to be heard. And that's, it's an uncomfortable moment to sit in that silence and recognize somebody else's pain.
Especially if they've given you the opportunity to be that person that they tell it to. Right? You don't know how often they're saying it. They're not saying it to some random person. They might joke about it on stage and get a couple laughs. But when you're in a green room or you're one-on-one with somebody and they look at you and they tell you that, that's a important moment. And so maybe the first note of this podcast is, when somebody's telling you some pains or sorrows or something that feels crazy to you, like, sit and listen to it. It could just be true. Well, I do want to transition, Lori, into a few of the things, because your relationship with Tony was very close. You were his assistant, and now you are continuing to tell his story and allow others to tell his story. And so I want to start, if we could just run through some of these books and projects that you've worked on alongside of him or with him or since his passing, and just kind of talk about why the listener might be interested in picking them up. So first one is, in 2016, you came out with a book, like you mentioned, Appetites. It's a cookbook.
Yes.
That you were touring around for. Tell us about Appetites.
So Appetites is it's a family cookbook, although it's very much, you know, Tony Bourdain style. So the art is really unusual. The photo, some of the photos are really beautiful food photos. Some of the photos are really whacked out sort of conceptual art. And the cover itself is a really abstract portrait of Tony made by the illustrator Ralph Steadman. And this book is an absolute example of Tony's huge generosity and his willingness to share a platform and to lift other people up around him and to share his success and his access. You know, I was his assistant. I was a writer and editor, but I was, you know, mostly making plane reservations and dentist appointments and scheduling the housekeeper and, you know, not a very glamorous life. But he knew that I was a writer and I wanted to sort of keep my brain active. And he offered me the opportunity to co-author a cookbook with him, which I was just hugely grateful. And it was a lot of fun. I think it's a great book. It's, the recipes are solid. I've made them all many, many times. And, so that was our first collaboration. And I can just run through the others if you like.
Yeah. The next one that we'll touch on is World Travel, An Irreverent Guide.
So this is a book that we started on shortly after we finished the cookbook Appetites and it was out in the world. He said, well, let's do another book together. This went really well. And so we decided to do a travel guide that was based on all of the travel that he had done over the past, you know, almost 20 years of his career traveling for television. So it was drawing on all of those experiences, all of the television, all the other writing that he had done. You know, he had seen, you know, almost every country in the world and some of them many, many times. So we wanted to do sort of a very focused travel guide that doesn't hit every single place in the world that he went to, but it does hit on all of his favorite places and all the things that he thinks are really important. If you're going to go to Tanzania, if you're going to go to Mexico City, if you're going to go to Detroit, these are the places you should eat. These are the bars you should check out. This is why these places are important to him. So it's full of his own writing and the things that he shared on television. And then it's also got a lot of practical information and things that I kind of wrote in to stitch it all together to make it an actual useful travel guide.
That's an incredible gift to this world. I'll tell you that it's mm-hmm. awesome and very helpful and useful. And it's still to this day when my wife and I travel, I'll look up where to be. And there is something special to each one of these places. I've never been let down or confused mm-hmm. at how something made that list. Mm-hmm. The final one is the book that I'm in the middle of right now. I've not finished it, so I can't speak to length about it, but I'm in the middle of it. And it was a gift by my mother on my wedding day and said, hey, take this with you and read it on your honeymoon. So I did.
Wow.
It's called Bourdain, The Definitive Oral Biography.
Yes. So this is a book that I started very shortly after Tony died. The idea came up in a conversation between myself and my literary agent, who was also Tony's agent, and Tony's longtime editor, Daniel Halpern at Echo, which is an imprint of HarperCollins. The idea was there are so many people now coming out of the woodwork in the wake of Tony's death who want to try and cash in and tell his story in a way that is sensational and really doesn't have any connection to who the man was. It's just people seeing an opportunity to tell a sensational story. So why don't we do something that really comes from a place of knowing and love and understanding that really gets at more of Tony's story. Now, he told a lot of his own story in Kitchen Confidential, which was the 2000 memoir that really kind of broke him out and catapulted him into this, you know, public life. This book, Bourdain, The Definitive Oral Biography, tells what I like to think is the rest of his story. The stuff that was going on behind the scenes, the perspectives of people that have been around him his whole life. So I did about 100 interviews with people, everyone from his now late mother, his brother Christopher, his first wife Nancy, his second wife Otavia, his daughter Ariane, to guys he went to high school with, guys he cooked with in Provincetown in the 70s and 80s, his New York City kitchen crew from the 80s and 90s, people who made television with him, people who did publishing projects with him, you know, friends he picked up along the way, just a really interesting cross-section of people. Anderson Cooper from CNN, Nigella Lawson, the British culinary icon, just people who knew Tony in all different ways and had great stories about him, great insights into sort of what made him tick. And as interesting as he was on camera as a television personality, he was much, much more interesting as a fully realized very intelligent, very driven, very complex human being.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because complex was the word that came to mind so often when I thought about doing this interview with you through this whole thing. And there was some complexity even on how to talk to you because you are so incredible and accomplished. These works that we're even speaking about, and yes, Tony is, his name's on one of them, his picture's on another, his list is on another, but behind that and within that is you. And so as we close out this interview, I want to ask you a few questions. In the grieving process, when you found out about Tony's passing, a close friend of yours, also your coworker, your boss, somebody that you obviously cared for, what changed in you during that time?
Oof. It was, I got very, very quiet. You know, I just, I really didn't want to see people except the people that were very close with Tony. And I just had to sort of figure out what does my life look like. I thought my life was going in a certain direction, you know, and I really had to take stock of, you know, what my skills were, what my assets were, what I was left with, and you know, what Tony might have wanted for me to do in his absence. So it was a really, really transformative time for me. I also happened to be getting divorced right at the same time, and I got sober at this right around the same time. So it was a huge transformation in my life. You know, everything changed, and my life was unrecognizable. You know, some good, some bad. I mean, I would gladly make restaurant reservations and dentist appointments again to have Tony still around. You know, as much as I'm happy to be, you know, in a different phase of my career now, I would gladly go back to being an assistant if I could, if it meant that Tony would come back. But yeah, there was a lot of growing up for me to do, I think. You know, I think as someone who also has struggled with addiction, I don't think I truly recognized the addict in Tony until I was able to kind of come to terms with the addict in myself. So it's been a really transformative couple of years for me. I do find a lot of hope in talking to the people that love Tony, that wanted the best for him, you know, people who were equally devastated by his death. And I find a lot of hope in, you know, the number of people who continue to respond to stories about him, people who are, doing writing and making television and trying to do things in his image. I think that's a really positive influence that he made on the world.
Hey everybody, it's Ben here. I just wanted to tell you about Generous. Generous Coffee Company is a company my buddies and I started a few years ago with one simple purpose, to provide the highest quality coffee. So when you hear people talking about, oh my gosh, that's the best coffee I've ever had, well, Generous would fall into that category, specialty grade coffee. And then 100% of the profits are donated to nonprofits. We also have apparel and coffee mugs, but our coffee is really what drives us. So today, go visit us on Instagram at generous_coffee, or please, please go visit our website, generouscoffee.com. You can buy some coffee for yourself, for your business, for your school, for your church, for your family. It's a great gift, and we would love to provide it to you. So please, go out there today, buy some coffee. We look forward to having you as our guest and our client. It would be such a cool partnership, and I would love to hear what you think, so please review us online. Again, that's generouscoffee.com. 100% of the profits are donated to nonprofits. Next question, which is a big one. And I'm going to start with you. Mm-hmm. A lot of this, obviously, this episode in particular is about grieving, and it's about mental health, and it's about the projects that you're working on and how we continue to tell Tony's story and share your story. And I'm going to ask the same question about Tony. But for you, how do you want to be remembered now? You just said this is a whole new season for you. You went through a divorce. You got sober. You lost a friend. We're only 3.5 years out of that. This is still very fresh. So as you move into this next season of life, how do you want to be remembered?
Well, gosh, I don't think anyone's ever asked me that before. You know, I'm only 47, so I hope that I've got, you know,
that's
some
right.
time
I hope so
to
too.
Continue to make a mark. But if not, you know, the thing that I always think about that kind of motivates me every day is, you know, what is the work that I haven't done yet, that if I were to get a terminal diagnosis, or, you know, what do I want? What's left undone? And for me, it is, you know, writing in my own voice and telling my own story. I've gotten very good at channeling Tony and, you know, writing about him, and I've had a career of writing about other people, or interviewing other people, or ghost writing for other people. And so what I'm working on now, starting to work on, is to tell my own story in part about sobriety, about, you know, losing a friend to suicide, about my experiences and adventures with Tony and before I knew him, you know, living in New York, being in the food scene and the media scene for a long time. So I'm hoping to tell my own story with some humor, with honesty, and with hopefully with insights that people can recognize in themselves, and you know, maybe some lessons that people can take and on their own, whether it's a quest for sobriety or a quest to for better mental health, or just learning how to cook a fried egg really well. You know, I'd like to share all of that with people.
And how do you want Tony to be remembered?
Well, you know, I his daughter, I think, puts it really well in the book, and it's hard to top this. She's got the last quote in the oral biography, and she said, "I just want people to remember Tony as someone who really opened people's minds, who got people out of their comfort zones, who got them to think about people around the world, maybe countries they'd never even heard of, places they never thought to visit." If he can be remembered as somebody who changed perspectives, who opened minds, who brought people with disparate viewpoints to the table, I think that's a really beautiful way to be remembered. You know, there's plenty of people that he didn't agree with that he was able to sit down and share a meal with, or ask questions of, or try and understand where they were coming from, and not to change their minds and not to have his mind changed, but just to have a civil dialogue. And I think that was a really, really special thing that he was able to do. And I think we could definitely stand to have a lot more of that in this country right now.
Yeah, I would agree. Okay, well, one selfish question for me that I've always wondered before our final question that we ask everybody. You said that he had a hard time understanding why an auditorium would be filled up with people that had paid to hear him talk. Hmm. I was a fan. I was a supporter. Many that I know were, but I'm sure he had them out there. How did he deal with the critics in his life? Because I'm sure somebody listening is feeling like their family's critical, their friendships are critical, their job is critical, and they're trying to plug through, and they have their friends and family, but the critics are the loudest in their minds. How did he deal with the critics? This is something I've always wondered about him.
Yeah, you know, he had a couple of different ways of dealing with it. I think it depended on the circumstance, but I think that the thing that sticks with me the most is that I think he tried to learn from the critics. You know, he tried to, and it is not easy, and this is a daily practice that I try and remind myself of, but he was able to at least temporarily kind of couch his ego, recognize his ego, and put it aside and say, this is not about me or my ego. Someone is trying to give me information about myself. Maybe it's useful, maybe it's not. I can listen, but I'm not going to take it in. I'm not going to absorb it and let it destroy me, but I am going to listen, dispassionately, maybe just for 5-10 seconds. You know, maybe it's a very, very brief exercise. And then either if there's something I can learn from it, I'm going to try and learn from it. And if not, I'm going to let it go and I'm going to put it aside. And that was not always easy. I mean, you know, Tony had an ego like we all have egos. And I think there were times when it was really quite hurtful for him to hear criticism. But I think there is a journalist and a television writer named Andy Greenwald, who was a big fan of Tony's, but then wrote a pretty critical piece about him when he did his network television show, The Taste. He just thought, this is not cool. This is not the Tony Bourdain I know. He's selling out. I think he called him like a defanged circus lion. And I think at first that really, really hurt Tony. And then I think, you know, once that kind of wore off a little bit, he thought, well, you know, maybe he's got a point. And he ended up reaching out, talking to Andy Greenwald, and they did this really beautiful interview together afterward, you know, where they kind of, there was almost a respect, you know, because I think so many people were kissing his butt for such a long time, Tony. And I think, you know, that can get really boring. And I think it was interesting. He could see the value in someone having the courage to say, you know what, I'm not crazy about what you're doing. But I think, you know, the people who were just mean spirited or, you know, critical of, they didn't like his politics, or they didn't like his approach, or they didn't like his hair or his face or whatever it was. I think there was a point where some of that was hurtful to him, but I think he just, you know, I think it's take what's useful and leave the rest behind is something that I hear a lot. And I saw him do that to the best of his ability a lot of the time.
Final question for you. Again, it's Lori's books out there, co-authored with Anthony Bourdain, Appetites, also World Travel, An Irreverent Guide, and then finally her book, Bourdain, The Definitive Oral Biography, all worth reading, all super interesting, all worth grabbing, getting your hands on. All right, final question for you. Laura, do you believe, within any context, we have this answered in so many different ways, do you believe that hope still wins? If so, why? And if not, why not?
I do believe that hope still wins. If you had asked me a few years ago before I got sober, I would say, no way. I was very, very cynical. I thought I was, you know, uniquely miserable and that, you know, life was just a series of horrible challenges that I was going to fail. But getting sober, getting into the 12-step community, sort of surrendering to a God of my understanding again, which is not something I ever thought I would hear myself say. But it's been a tremendous source of hope, you know, and to touch base with people every day who want to help each other stay sober. To me, that is the most hopeful, the most beautiful thing. You know, I was raised Catholic. It's not a tradition that I have continued with. But I have, I was raised with a faith, and to be able to take some of that sort of the bones of that, and apply it to, this idea of a community of people who are supporting each other, and it doesn't have to be sobriety. You know, it doesn't even have to be a form of addiction. But if you've got a community of people that are looking out for each other, that are trying to live honest lives and trying to just do their best one day at a time, I think that is the most beautiful, hopeful thing that I have ever encountered. And I know that's not for everyone, but there are enough of us out there kind of looking out for each other that, yeah, I do think hope wins.
Lori, I really appreciate it. Thank you for joining Hope Still Wins.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for tuning in to today's episode of Hope Still Wins. If you haven't already, please subscribe or follow the show wherever you listen to podcasts. If you enjoyed this conversation, please consider leaving a 5-star review on Apple and join the community over on Instagram at Hope Still Wins. All right, that's it for today, my friends. As a reminder, make sure to grab a copy of Lori's new books, World Traveler and Bourdain, The Definitive Oral Biography, and check out the film Roadrunner. Trust me, it's worth the watch. Thank you again for listening to this week's episode of Hope Still Wins. I'm your host, Ben Higgins, and let's chat next week.